Hi. On the 5th and 6th of June 2024, I'll be speaking at the largest AI event in Asia, Super AI in Singapore, at the iconic Marina Bay Sands. Alongside brilliant minds like Edward Snowden, Benedict Devon, and Balaji Srinivasan, I'll be on a stage exploring the extraordinary potential of AI and the profound change it represents, not just for financial markets, but also for the world as we know it. With over 5,000 attendees and over 150 side events, Singapore will become a vibrant hub for a full week from the 3rd and 9th of June. Visit superai.com to register and join me with 20% off tickets using the code REALVISION. Use the link in the description and I'll see you there. It's going to be incredible.
What's driving the relentless tech rally? Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. With me today is Sven Heinrich, founder of Northman Trader. Hi, Sven.
Hi, Maggie. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. And it seems like so are tech stocks. Again, if we look across the U.S. market action today, we had the consumer price data out. Everyone was waiting for that big inflation read, but it didn't seem to make much of an impact. Instead, we just had this relentless move, NVIDIA dragging tech stocks higher again. We had most of the major indices higher, although the Russell was seemed like it was a laggard. What do you make of this market action?
Well, it's actually kind of the same trick pony we've seen all year. The data points actually don't seem to really matter. As bizarre as this sounds, I had a tweet out earlier today just highlighting that a lot of the correlations that we saw last year, for example, no longer seem to matter. You know, when we had higher yields, it used to matter. It doesn't. So markets go up no matter what the news is. Same with whether the dollar rises or goes down. Dollar went up quite a bit early part of the year, so the yields didn't matter. Same thing now with inflation data, or rate cut expectations, right? Initial rally was, oh, they're going to cut 7-8 times. Now it's kind of dwindled at 2 or 3. And still, markets keep acting the same way. It's fascinating, completely irrelevant. So what you have to do, looking at this from a trading perspective, is what is relevant, and that's the big hunt here. Well, there's been a couple of really key consistent factors amid of all these inconsistent, data points that produce the same reaction. And what is the consistency? One is simply easing financial conditions, driven by still massive liquidity flowing into this market. And a lot, not all, but a lot has to do with this incredible fiscal deficit that was part of the equation in 2023 and is part of the equation in 2024. And it continues to be this year, or perhaps even next year, and the year after, because they can't stop. In fact, when we're seeing, obviously, rates holding higher now, even for longer, this has a mathematical implication. Not only do we have continuous spending, but we also have continued financing of this spending with ever higher interest payments. Mm-hmm. The government is kind of stuck in a doom loop here because they have to refinance the debt. They have to pay the interest on the debt. We also have over $10 trillion in maturities coming to markets this year, where debt that was previously financed at much lower rates have to be refinanced at higher rates. Mm-hmm. And by doing so, you're increasing even more the interest payments that are due, and therefore you're going to have an even bigger deficit, right? So this is the era, what is now called fiscal dominance, which kind of mutes the Fed's efforts on, or perceived efforts on, tightening. You know, you also have still that liquidity facility, reverse repo, that is draining. It's still got about $450, $460 billion left in the tank. And all this liquidity, I submit to everyone, has found its way into risk assets, easing financial conditions, lots of liquidity in the system, and it goes into financial assets. And in part of the financial asset structure, the most attractive place is momentum. And AI offers the perfect momentum story and has for obviously the last year and a half. And so you have this continuous chase. So you find yourself all of a sudden in this really bizarre situation where you have some individual stocks just absolutely, you know, you look at it from a technical perspective and just scratch your head. I mean, the markets go through phases like this where they are rewarding recklessness and they're punishing discipline, because, you know, a disciplined person may say, well, this is just not a good risk reward. And in any other market setting, you would get your head chopped off chasing this. But in an environment such as this, it continues to drive dramatically. And then I should add one more factor before I close this part off. Mm-hmm. There's also a real issue structurally in terms of how the market's been operating. By very few cap tech stocks, high cap tech stocks, leading the advance by sheer force of their market cap expansions, i.e. NVIDIA, you know, adding $1 trillion in market cap in a couple of months. Unheard of. Never ever seen before. Okay. What that implies is that asset managers, by definitions, are lagging, because asset managers are not all heavily exposed to just those few stocks. They have a much broader exposure. So they're, by definition, lagging, and they continue to be forced to chase in one form or another. And so the chase is kind of, that's how you get these momentum moves, because it just, you know, it's not something maybe that they want to do, but that they're forced to do. That's why you see a lot of month and markups and so forth, right? So it's an uncomfortable situation. And, you know, you mentioned small caps at the outset. Yeah, small caps, for example, would get maybe pressured more by inflation remaining stickier. And so again, you have that divergence in the market. But for now, it continues to tick as clean as it possibly can be. I'm actually impressed, you know, with some of the action that we've seen in stocks like NVIDIA and many others that are just, you know, vastly overbought. If you would look at it in a standard metric, I mean, we're talking weekly RSI indexes in the 90s. When do you see that? I.e. never. And yet the S&P is tracking as clean as a whistle in its channel. It has virtually no pullbacks. We haven't seen a 2% pullback all year at all. And, you know, you got to be impressed by how clean it is. You have to be, I guess, a bit worried about how narrow it is. But at the same time, you know, as long as the trend doesn't break, you know, it can continue to go higher. And that's where one has to be very careful. You know, you got to respect the strength, but also know when things have changed. That's kind of.
Yeah, I think that there's so much to unpack there, but it's such a perfect explanation. But I think what you really put your finger on is why it feels so uncomfortable, because we sort of, everyone kind of knows that not only does it not sort of correlate with the traditional, you know, what we would have traditionally seen or come to expect, or maybe in some cases, the traditional framework you might've used to make a decision. I love that observation that this kind of market rewards recklessness and punishes discipline, because, you know, we were taught to try to have some discipline when we're looking at things, and that recklessness, it never ends well, right? So then everyone's kind of forced to stay in this. It's like being on a runaway train. I mean, you know, something horrible is going to happen, but you can't let go or get off, or a lot of people are afraid to. So I just think that was such a great explanation. So we already have some questions coming in, and I will get to them. But, you know, since you bring this up in this doom loop of this fiscal dominance, it's such a perfect segue, because we are looking at that all week as part of this 2-week series we're doing, How to Unfuck Your Future. And this week is a real focus on exactly that, exactly this, these huge levels of debt, right? Raul kicked it off talking about debt, demographics, and deflation, and the havoc that's wreaking in some places, and what it means, you know, some of the outcomes and some of the challenges it's setting up. And one of the things that we talked about today in the second episode is the geopolitical, there's a lot of political outcomes, or it's influencing a lot of what's happening around the world in terms of how people are feeling, some of the rise in populism that we're seeing. What this means is feeling of volatility and uncertainty. I want to play a little clip from something Dee Smith and Jacob Shapiro had the conversation. Let's play a clip from Jacob, and then we'll talk on the other side.
And I'll also just say, I'll date myself as somebody, I'm a geriatric millennial. I'm sort of in that elder millennial generation. And it's, we're angry at our politicians and that older generations precisely because they're borrowing from the future to pay for the things that they want right now. It's not, we're not angry because the price of avocado toast has increased by 2 or 3 times. We're angry because we see all the debt that's being racked up. Expecting that when we get to the age that the boomers and others are right now, that there's going to be nothing left for us because we've already borrowed everything. So at least on that level, it rains home.
Hey, everyone. We're going to take a quick break right now to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Join over 5,000 attendees for the largest AI event in Asia at Super AI Singapore, June 5th and 6th, 2024. Raoul Pal, Benedict Evans, Balaji Srinivasan, Edward Snowden, and over 150 others will join the industry's most influential to explore and unveil the next wave of transformative AI technologies. Singapore will become a vibrant AI hub for a week from June 3rd through June 9th with over 150 side events that will make for unparalleled networking opportunities. Visit www.realvision.com/superAI for 20% off tickets with the code REALVISION or click below.
Good news and bad news. First, the bad news. Mint is shutting down. The good news? There's an even better alternative. Many Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it. Monarch is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all of your accounts, investments, transactions, cash flow, net worth, and more. Plus, create custom budgets, track progress toward financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now listeners of this show will get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/vision. Monarch has a tool that allows you to easily import your data from Mint and keep all of your tags and categories. It's the most customizable budgeting app. Change the layout of your dashboard, toggle between light and dark mode, create custom budgets and notifications, set up automatic rules for transactions and notifications, and more. Monarch is obsessed with constantly improving the product. They release updates every 2 weeks and allow customers to submit suggestions, vote on requested features, and view the product roadmap. After reading the reviews, I can see why it's the top-rated personal finance app. And right now, listeners of this show will get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/vision. That's monarchmoney.com/vision for your extended 30-day free trial. Go to monarchmoney.com/vision.
This was such a fantastic conversation. It was a very smart conversation about what's happening. And Jacob came out swinging as an optimist out of the gate, but then he and Dee sort of found a lot of agreement in the middle. But it was really interesting to hear their slightly different takes on things. And, you know, we pushed a little bit ahead about what's happening in the future. You can see the whole thing on the website, and we have a special deal going on, 14 days of RV Plus for just $1. Nothing inflationary about that. So take advantage of it and watch these shows. They're amazing. We're going to have a big sort of finale at the end, but we want to hear your commentary. So jump in the comment section, and there is a channel dedicated to the series now, an event channel. You can look for it on the website in the top right when you go to the homepage, or if you go to the globe on the bottom right, you'll see it. So jump in and share your thoughts. We're going to pull them for a conversation Raoul and I have next week. Sven, I thought that was such an interesting conversation. We know people are really mad about inflation. We know this has been an issue as we head certainly into the elections here in the U.S., but everywhere. But it's not just the inflation. It's just this general feeling that, as you say, we're kind of trapped in this unsustainable situation with all of this fiscal spending and the interest payments getting higher. And does it feel like, I mean, what are your thoughts about that? Does it feel like that is going to continue to drive what's happening in financial markets? And how does anybody figure out what's going on if that's the case? We haven't really been here before, have we?
No, we have not. I mean, for example, last year we had debt spending out of GDP about 6.3%. It's not been the most drastic spending that we've seen. Certainly COVID that year was worse. Even the global financial crisis was a little bit worse, but it is by far, and I mean really by far, the most dramatic deficit spending vis-a-vis the economy that we've ever seen, not being in a recession. This is the type of response you would expect to see if you are in a recession. And the reason you see this type of spending in a recession is twofold. One, obviously, complete revenue fall off from the drop in economic activity. But the second, obviously, is stimulative spending. Okay. And for them to do that in this type of environment, I think everybody has to be super clear. You know, the growth numbers we see in the economy, because last year everybody's talking about recession, recession, recession. Well, maybe the counter question is, can you even have a recession when you have that much fiscal stimulus in the system? I would argue with you that if we didn't have that high deficit, growth numbers wouldn't be anywhere near where they are. So we're all walking kind of through rose-colored glasses in terms of what's actually going on in the real economy. And perhaps the clip you just referenced gives you a sense that maybe with what's going on is you have the, you know, the paper economy that looks so good, but you have the experience of people that is very different in terms of how they're actually faring in that economy. You know, it's probably pretty rough, I would say, psychologically. You keep seeing headlines of new market highs and billionaires getting ever richer and the top 1% doing ever better. While you see your rent keep increasing, which is the largest line item in any family's budget, when your cost of living is so much higher than it was before COVID. And let's not kid ourselves, when they talk about getting inflation down to 2%, they're not talking about prices coming anywhere near close to where they were. It's just the rate of change over time. Mm-hmm. And so everybody, myself included, and you, everybody is stuck with permanently higher prices. And unless you own assets, which I hate to say, most people don't, because 90% of financial assets are owned by the top 10%. Okay. And then it trickles off rather dramatically. And so what you have is this vast wealth inequality curve that has been expanding from cycle to cycle to cycle, and it keeps getting worse to the point that the middle class has actually really been shrinking for the last 30 years. And it breeds ever more discontentment. That discontentment may not be aware of the specific mechanics of how the powers that be work the financial system, but it filters itself throughout the political discourse. I would argue, in general, we see globally, not only in the United States, we see ever more fragmentation of the electorate to extremes to the right and to the left. And it makes actually political consensus ever more difficult. Okay. And so when you never get a proper cleansing, and unfortunately now we're in the point where the cleansing would actually hurt again the middle class, the poorest and the poor. But you cannot deny that what we've been seeing even here in the last 4 years is dramatic in terms of how that is now again getting to the point where, you know, the middle class is struggling with the real costs. They're struggling with the high rates that are in the system, while the asset owners are benefiting from loosening financial conditions, from all this liquidity that is going in. And so you're looking, and I'm sure when we're going to get the data again after the first quarter and the second quarter, you're going to see the top 0.1%. They were already over $20 trillion in wealth among just 136,000 households. It's actually stunning, the numbers.
It's hard to imagine. And D. Smith said something so poignant and so true right after we actually stopped rolling. So I'll just share this with all of you. But we were talking about it. He's got grandkids. I have teenagers. And we were just sort of, empathizing with each other and the future, this uncertain future. And he said, we're in the same canoe. We're all in the same canoe. And I don't think he chose that boat reference lightly, because it's very precarious and tippy, but it's true. So I know a lot of people don't want to hear about wealth inequality, but man, it's going to come for you at some point. When I first started covering economics and finance a million years ago, I'm not going to say when, but a very smart economist was talking about demographics and talking about generational warfare, right? Generational strains like we haven't seen. And everyone kind of thought it was completely. And I think about that conversation I had with him all the time right now. This is why one of the D's Ryle talked about is demographics in this series. So, and you're right, Sven, most people can't really put their finger on why they feel horrible or why the system's not working for them anymore. Again, part of what we're trying to do with this series, because we care about education, is help focus people's minds on what's really going on, lift the cover back, because if you at least can understand the challenge, you can start to think about some solutions and a way forward. Speaking of that, we have a question from Bob. It's an easy one. How do you see the doom loop resolving, Sven? Gold revaluation is getting a lot of talk lately. It's an awful big question. Maybe another way to phrase it is, what's sort of top of mind as you see this playing out?
A few years ago, I was of the view that, the best way to solve all this, after they kept intervening with QE 1, 2, 3, and 4 of the financial crisis, I was getting concerned about these asset price disconnects and asset bubbles. And I was concerned at some point we're going to see something significant in terms of our right sizing, which I thought actually would be helpful in the sense that once you have a cleansing and you can have a proper discussion about maybe how to restructure things in a better way. But also became clear to me then in the follow through on COVID that they were never going to let that happen. The size of interventions that we've seen since then and the clever way in how the so-called bear market of 22 was managed, and I use that word on purpose because what you should have seen after this insane money printing of following COVID, you should have seen some proper cleansing in terms of volatility and in terms of everything. Yes, we saw individual stocks drop hard. We saw some of that. But we saw the most controlled bear market in history, in that anytime we got just so close to a break of actual technical significance, it was averted. And it was averted by none other than Mrs. Yellen. Janet Yellen, I jokingly referred to it as kind of the Yellen factor, being concerned. We saw that in October of 22, when she came out and she was concerned about liquidity in treasury market. We saw it in March, during the banking crisis, when she was concerned. And guess what? Every time she came out, it was the end of the VIX. I don't think any party, because this larger asset disallocation has gotten so large that perhaps a cleansing is no longer possible without a larger catastrophe in terms of the economy. Everything is now so dependent. Look, markets used to be smaller than the economy. 80s was like 60, 80% of GDP. We had the tech bubble in 2000. That's when things got crazy. Why did things go crazy in 2000? Not only because of the great internet story, but part of it was because Greenspan and the Fed were worried about Y2K, right? The computers were supposed to blow up. So guess what they did? They added a bunch of liquidity into the system in advance, right? And it just helped propel everything to just extreme measures, which at the time was about, you know, 140, 150% market cap to GDP. It was unheard of before. And then when did it crash? When they removed the liquidity, very simple. And then the crash produced a recession. In after COVID, we got to 200% market cap to GDP. It was just never seen before. Yes, you can make arguments about big cap tech stocks being global and therefore maybe deserve a higher market cap to GDP vis-a-vis the US economy. Fair enough. But 200% is so dramatic that it used to be that markets reacted to the economy. Now the economy reacts to markets. If you have a major drawdown in markets with everything been financialized, with all 401ks and everybody long and everything just collateralized through the same thing, you're going to feel an immediate reaction in the economy, right? Because spending goes down, consumer confidence goes down, everything is intertwined. So you got this massive market beast that you gotta, if you're a policymaker, and the Fed will never admit this, because they don't want to be perceived to being in the business of managing markets. But because the market is so large vis-a-vis the economy, and it is again, it's like 185% market cap to GDP again. We're right. The 2000 tech bubble peak was the bottom in October 22, literally in terms of market cap to GDP. So we are by definition in uncharted territory here. And again, the reaction on how they managed the 22 bear market tells me that they did not want things to really get crazy. We saw that with an ever lower high in the VIX. It was volatility was very controlled. So now we're finding ourselves, and this is all tying back to debt, because all growth, and at the end of the day, is debt finance. If you ran a balanced budget right now, we'd be having a full-blown recession.
We're going to take another quick break to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes our cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help get your pet the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/realvision. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/realvision. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/realvision. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
So what do we... We have some people asking thoughts on gold, on silver, on copper. What about bonds? So what do you do against that backdrop? How are you thinking about if it looks like a cleansing isn't going to resolve it? Is there anything that you like, see opportunity in, or feel safe in?
Well, I got mocked pretty hard when I turned bullish on Bitcoin a couple of years ago. This was after
you're feeling Bitcoin. All right now.
Yeah, we had the initial 50% drop. It went into the 30s, low 30s. And Michael Saylor and I had a discussion and I came out bullish for all the arguments. And the view was to buy weakness in Bitcoin as a bear market would unfold. And, you know, that was one of the strategies we employed. The other one is just to be consistently practical with regards to asset classes in the stock market. And, you know, I've been bullish all of last year and continue to be bullish, but also being very practical in terms of risk reward, because, you know, now things are getting obviously extremely stretched. And I want to highlight something here for you, which I thought might be of interest, because the rally we're seeing currently is one of the longest we've seen in over 50 years. It's very unusual by definition, not only the angle and the descent and the narrowness of it all, but there's only been literally a couple of occasions where we've seen something like that. So being mammals, looking pattern seeking mammals, always want to look at some precedences for that. And one of which is of interest here is 2017. And I wanted to, if you have that chart, if you can pull that up, the comparison. First, general comments. I call them super rallies, and we've seen them a number of times over the years. And one of the key indicators I use for those in terms of assessing control is the weekly 5 EMA exponential moving average. And as when you have these super rallies, basically, as you know, every time it gets dinged, it holds its support. And as long as that is the case, the rally is intact. It's not until you break the weekly 5 EMA on a weekly close and it becomes resistance, then you're then in a bear phase. And the bear phase may last just 2 or 3 weeks, or may last a bit longer. That is always dependent on each market segment. But to see a rally this long staying above the weekly 5 EMA without any correction is highly unusual. And so basically our strategy has been simply being, you know, every 5 EMA tag you buy. And by the way, if you can't tell which one of these is which,
it tells you what you need to know.
Tells you what you need to know. And it's fascinating, because if you look at the two chart comparisons, they're acting almost identical. Now, no year is exactly alike, but in terms of the structure, we're seeing the same thing. You know, the lower chart actually being 2024 and the upper chart being 2017. What was 2017? It was also a big year about liquidity. You know, tax cuts were coming in and so forth. So the lesson here is to say, okay, well, as long as this, and you, let me just say this very clearly also, analogs work until they don't. And ultimately, they always come to an end. But my view is, as long as it works, you want to be respectful of it, right? And what 2017, for example, says, ironically, what comes next is a bit of a pullback, nothing dramatic. It would be, if it continues to track, it would say, well, maybe into late March, we have something of the 5% variety, nothing dramatic whatsoever. Then it consolidates for a couple of months, and then it just keeps going. It keeps going through the rest of the year. There's another rally, and I didn't bring a chart for this because it would just hurt everybody's brain. And that is 1995. 1995, the rally started actually later in the year of 1994, but it had the same characteristic, which means every single 5 EMA tag was a buy, and it kept going throughout the entire year, and it went into 1996. I cannot discount that possibility, given the fact that nothing's changed as of this moment. But I'm having also intellectual issue with it, because at the current ascent, as this rally has progressed, if we just extrapolate that into the end of the year without any breaks of the weekly 5 EMA and it just keeps going without any pausing, you would end up at, you know, S&P 7500. You know, I can believe a lot of things, but I'm having a hard time believing that. Unless AI literally takes over the entire stock market, and that's the end of that. Now, that doesn't either make me a, you know, complacent bull here. I'm just recognizing that these super rallies that have gone this long, even in the early 70s, have never produced a larger bear market until later. Okay. Mm. And to the extent that fiscal dominance continues to control everything here, we just all have to be cognizant that volatility may remain compressed. In fact, that 2017 analog I just mentioned, it also had extreme volatility compression. And you never, ever, ever saw the VIX go above 17 in all of that year. And by the end of the year, the VIX was in its lowest phase ever. I mean, it dropped below 10. So, you know, there's always the possibility that 2024 is not going to be 2017 or 1996. It may just be 2024, which has all kinds of other possibilities, right? Certainly, you know, we, because of the fiscal stimulus, we may all forget about the lag effects of this rate hike cycle.
Right, right. That's been the tricky question, right? We still have to figure out. We just don't know because we haven't been here.
And you never do. And I just want to maybe highlight also part of history, since I've been around long enough. You know, I see all the soft landing talk from Yellen and Powell and everybody on, and Biden and everybody on down. You know, and economists and Goldman Sachs and everybody's talking soft landing. Well, sorry, folks. That, look at the news cycle in 2006 and 2007. Ben Bernanke himself went in front of Congress in January of 2008, just before everything blew up, and stated the Fed sees no for recession. Very good. You know, the issue we have is when you come out of a rate hike cycle, you know, there's all this angst about rising yields and the inverted yield curve. It's not the inverted yield curve that produces a recession. It's the reinversion. Mm-hmm. It's when the lag effects take hold. And to the extent that we've now seen fiscal dominance maybe push everything on the back burner and now forces the Fed to stay higher for longer, you know, we may all find ourselves facing the consequences of the lag effects later. I mean, there are concerning issues. For example, you know, in order to have a growing economy, you need to have an expansion in commercial and industrial loans. Guess what? They're negative. Industrial production, not doing anything.
Yep.
Retail sales, not so hot. And you know, when I look at over $1 trillion in credit card debt and credit card interest rates assessed by commercial banks sitting there at 22-23%, good luck. I mean, ultimately, you know, if you look at personal interest payments, they've skyrocketed as well. So going back to your earlier clip in terms of people being angry and frustrated with debt and this, that, and the other, the obligations are real. It's not like they've gone away. And it's, you know, you can argue as long as the labor market holds in, people can sustain that debt. But look at all the unemployment statistics over the last 50, 60 years. You know, when unemployment is at its lowest, it always feels at its best. But historically, that's also the most dangerous time, because there is zero history, none whatsoever, that unemployment is staying low. Okay. And now, can they kick the can further? Sure. In fact, I had a 10-year cycle chart that says, you know, year five in a 10-year cycle is fantastically bullish. And so, you know, maybe we continue on a path where, you know, any pullbacks you get, even if you get a proper correction this year, we'll just end up getting bought. And the consequences won't come home to roost until the seventh or eighth year, which the 10-year cycle suggests. The problem is we're all grappling on the one hand with, you know, unprecedented circumstances that are hard to compare to previous periods. And to me, that includes the leadership we have. I mean, take Yellen and Powell. They've been on the horn for years, and it's news every time when they say it. You know, the high U.S. deficit is not sustainable. Well, they keep saying it, but they keep presiding over the absurdity that we see now. You know, and you know, if you do math, you got to realize that at some point, the system chokes itself by the obligations that are not only happening now, but are going to get much, much, much worse.
Exactly, which is why it circles back to politics as well, which is why we talked to Dean and Jacob today, because the elected officials are the ones who set the budget. It's very interesting, very, very difficult landscape, Sven. And yeah. I think you really kind of laid it out.
And I just want to highlight that point because you mentioned politics. I mean, maybe that's another reason people are getting frustrated, because they feel like they're not being leveled with. I mean,
I'd say that's the understatement of the show.
I mean, at least pretend, right? I mean, the budget came out, the new budget was proposed this week, and they literally went out there with a straight face and projecting debt of $45 trillion in a decade. Are you kidding me? Are you really kidding me? We just added $11 trillion in debt in the last 4 years. Okay, COVID was part of it, but we're now in a situation where we're adding $1 trillion in new debt every 100 days. Yeah. We're already almost at $35 trillion. Tell me how you're getting to $45 trillion in 10 years. It's just simply not believable, especially if you look at the outlays that are already mandated. Not talking about elective.
I think people somehow know that, even if they don't. I think that that's sort of adding to this, just this feeling of the future being so hard. So it's a murky thing. But listen, I think it's so important to take the time to talk about it, so that everyone can have an understanding of what's going on. Because I mean, we're sitting here getting questions about where should I put my money? What do you like? Well, you can't begin to answer that question unless you have a sense of what's really going on. So thank you for that, Sven. It was a fantastic conversation. I just love so many of the things you said. It was so good and smart. We thank you for sharing that knowledge with us. And on that note, we have Andreas and Dario Perkins on tomorrow, pulling the lid back on central banks. You know they're going to be extending some of the points that Sven just brought up right now about what's really going on. What do they know? What don't they know? What are they afraid to talk about? And are they kind of all trapped? By the way, we have more than 50 elections happening around the world in 2024, too, just to add to that sense of volatility. So there's a lot to talk about. Sven, so great to catch up with you. Come back again soon.
Thanks, Maggie. Take care.
Thanks. Appreciate the great questions. Keep them going in the event channel and in the comment section, and we'll pull them all together and talk about it with Raul and in our workshops next week. Stay tuned for all of that. Thanks, everybody. Take care and good luck out there.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. At Real Vision, we arm you with the expert knowledge, time-efficient tools, and a powerful network to help you succeed on your financial journey. Get a taste of financial freedom with our free offer at realvision.com/free.